Super Talk Mississippi Media Production.
This is Gerard Gibbert, and thank you for listening to Middays here on Super Talk Mississippi.
Middays with Gerard Gibbert is on the air. Middays with Gerard Gibbert is powered by C Spire. Power your home or business with C Spire fiber. To learn more, visit supertalk.fm/C Spire. C Spire fiber powers Super Talk Mississippi.
Get ready. Get ready to go beyond the headlines and join a meaningful conversation with people from around the state. You're listening to Middays with Gerard Gibbert here on Super Talk Mississippi.
Everyone, and welcome to Midday Super Talk Mississippi. I'm your host, Gerard Gibbert, along with Rhino in the Element Wealth Studio, guiding you through the middle of your day with facts, fodder, and fine music. Morning there, Rhino.
Howdy, howdy.
I just spoke to our colleague, Lance Talbert. He said that he had to have a canoe to get from the parking lot up to the studio when he arrived this morning, as the torrential rains swept through the great state of Mississippi, especially here in central Mississippi. It woke me up. It was one of those deals where it was just continuous thunder. Wasn't like intermittent strikes of thunder. It was like just continuous as those storms moved through the area. More coming again, right, in the middle of the week.
Well, if this is, I'm trying to get the radar to come up because all I'm looking at is a 5 minute old picture. But as of 5 minutes ago, if you are in the southernmost counties of the Magnolia State, you're still getting hit by it.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah. So still moving through that area of the state, sweeping through the Magnolia State this morning, coming, of course, from the west, going to the east. The markets, wow. What a sell off we had. And the red ink continues this morning, though the Dow has just turned positive. Earlier this morning, huge sell-off. That's because tariffs are coming back again, more tariffs, on Wednesday, April the 2nd. Liberation Day, as the president describes it. The NASDAQ was down over 450 earlier. It's now only down 300, only 300. And by the way, your price of gas looks like it is headed up. The price of oil sitting around $71 a barrel. The Dow has turned positive. Lots of news on that front. Mainly what's driving another sell-off today is Goldman Sachs has increased its recession risk to 35%. That doesn't sound like a lot, but it's enough to get the attention of the investment community. And they've issued the old sell sheets as a result, and that's driving the markets down. I think just a lot of uncertainty going on, a lot of queasiness about Mr. Trump's tariff policies, and he's made it clear that it's short-term pain for long-term gain. He also came out and said that he couldn't care less whether or not his tariffs increase the price of vehicles. He says, buy American if you don't like the price of vehicles increasing as a result of his tariffs. Now, it's kind of hard to buy an all-American vehicle. Doing a little research on that, about half the 16 million vehicles sold in this country are made here, and of the half that are made here, about half of their components come from abroad. So effectively, a quarter of total new vehicles are fully American and thus not subject to the tariffs.
Yeah, even the highly touted Tesla.
Yeah, imports.
You
a
got
lot
some
of parts.
People out there that were saying, oh, yeah, the Tesla is 100% made in America. I mean, it's built in America.
Right.
But It's only about 75%.
And let's be honest, that's right. And the reason that these automakers, as many other manufacturers, shifted production abroad, be it for parts or final assembly, is because of the cost of labor. Now, they don't want to admit that, but it was the egregious demands of labor unions in this country that drove them abroad. You and I have talked about it many, many times and appreciate you doing the research on this. I've shared it with lots of friends. What did we figure out? $9 a day for a auto worker
on the lower end, yeah, $8 or $9 a day.
And I haven't looked at it lately, but you estimated 20. I said 30 an hour on average for an auto worker. And that's just the base pay. We're not talking about the benefits lapped onto that, which, of course, you know, unions negotiate very, very lucrative benefits, and that's cost to the company. So when you look at the labor cost, you can't just look at if, for example, the average hourly wage is $20, you've got to add about another 25% on top of that for what's called the burden, maybe 30% in some cases. So add another $6, $7, $5, $6, $7, and that's where you land. Well, heck, that's more than an auto worker in Mexico earns in a day per hour, almost three times as much. So, of course, that's a major cost. That's why I predicted that the factories of the future, should there be any reshoring, which is the goal here. The goal is to induce these companies to build factories in this country, manufacture in this country. They won't be full of people. They'll be highly automated. Highly automated, just a handful of people in the plants making vehicles. I was shocked to find out, Rhino, in my research, I can't remember if we talked about that, I being off on Friday, that only about 900,000 people work in the auto industry in this country. 900,000. I was shocked to find out how low that number is. And that's still with a fairly robust industry domestically. And that's, I think, a result of massive automation and technology that's really changed the landscape of automobile manufacturing in a good way. If those factories were full of people, you think a car is expensive now? Imagine if people were performing many of those manufacturing tasks as opposed to machines that, by the way, don't get sick, quit, or take vacation. They don't sue you and all the other myriad of risks and costs associated with people. So naturally, businesses are always looking to automate as much as they can. And heck, I'm reminded again of the Longshoremen Union, who have effectively negotiated with their employers. Don't you go automating these jobs now. You got to save those for people. We got to write that information down on a clipboard. By the way, we need two, and you're going to pay us $80,000 a year, right? It's a true story. It's the most ass-backwards things I've ever heard. Don't you guys try to get efficient? What if we applied that to government? Oh, excuse me, we already do. That's why we're $36 trillion in debt and run $2 trillion deficits. Because we have eschewed any attempt to automate these tasks that these career bureaucrats make that are entrenched in these jobs. Man, is that landscape ever changing? And that's a good thing. Back here at home, sorry I wasn't with you on Friday. Stepped away from the mic to address the Mississippi chapter of the American Council of Engineering Companies. Delightful group. Really appreciate that. The opportunity to speak to those folks. And, of course, what's the top of everybody's mind is taxes. You guys know by now, we got a tax deal. Governor Tate Reeves had quite the ceremony end of last week, to celebrate this milestone of elimination of the state's income tax. Now, honestly, I think it's fair to say it's been met with a bit of resistance. And what I mean by that is just paying attention on social media, to the extent that that is any accurate gauge or benchmark. And I'm curious on our text line what folks think. There seems to be a negative reaction. And it's largely because a couple of things. One is the elimination occurs over a 14-year period of time. And had the Senate bill been enacted without the drafting errors, I dare say it would have been eliminated over an even longer duration of time. But as it stands right now, I'm calling the so-called triggers worthless. They're worthless. If we get to a situation where applying those trigger tests doesn't yield the ability to reduce the income tax by the prescribed rate in the bill, we got much bigger problems if that's the situation. All right, we're going to step aside for a break right now. We're just getting started on middays on this Monday at 11:05. It's Representative Rob Robertson. He chairs the House Education Committee. We'll get his thoughts on this legislative session. I think they're gaveling in today, right, Rhino, at 1 o'clock. Stay tuned. Coming right back in the Element Wealth Studio.
And he like his fancy clothes. And he like to wear...
This segment of Middays with Gerard Gibbert is brought to you by Covington County Hospital in Collins, where your health matters.
Now back to Middays with Gerard here on Super Talk Mississippi.
In the Element Well studio, so I got to share this with you. The Mississippi House is talking about creating a little band. And so they've approached me about being the drummer. Representative Dan Eubanks is spearheading this effort. And he sent me the playlist of he created on Spotify. You know, what they intend to perform. That's one of the tunes, by the way. How about that? And have you ever seen The Rain, also, by CCR?
You got to lobby to get Inagata DeVita in there.
I don't know. In my age, I have the strength to, but to play the old Inagata DeVita's drum solo like I did as a young drummer. Oh, my gosh. But that was kind of the litmus test in my day for being a drummer. That and Wipeout, of course.
And according to The Simpsons, it's the cure for the hiccups. Just put a metal trash can on somebody's head and play the drum solo from Inagata DeVita, and you're done. They won't have the hiccups or they won't care anymore.
I love it. Oh, man. We'll see where this goes. There's only one problem. I don't have any drums anymore. I got to go buy some drums. I've been scoping them out over the weekend. I used to play Rogers drums in my day. They were very popular. Back in that time period, from England. Jolly old England, I think, is where Rogers drums were made and popularized by many of the big groups in those days. Chicago's Danny Seraphin, I believe, played Rogers drums, as I recall. And I was a big, at least attempted to emulate Seraphin as best I could. But it ought to be fun if this comes to pass. I look forward to it. I've been listening to the tunes and practicing the licks a little bit, trying to memorize it. Some of those songs are not exactly the ones that I listen to for pleasure on a regular basis, so I'm trying to become acquainted with them. That ought to be fun. Drift Away, Dobie Grace, the one we play here on the show a lot. I would say at least these aren't super complex songs for, we're not playing Neil Peart and Rush here, which nobody can emulate, or John Bonham and Led Zeppelin and many others, of course. Just thinking about my days. I know I'm dating myself, and that's fine. Ought to be fun. Looking forward to it. So, back on taxes in Mississippi. I haven't checked the text line, just trying to get a feel, but You got the folks in the PERS program. Of course, Thomas and Greenwood makes it clear he, as the Trump we shared with you in the last segment, President Donald Trump said, quote, I couldn't care less if the price of vehicles rises as a result of tariffs. Thomas couldn't care less if the members of PERS do not receive their benefit checks. Is that a fair assessment, Rhino, based on he doesn't really give too much credence to the members of PERS' complaints about. But a lot of it, unfortunately, is hyperbole and not rooted in fact. They're all nervous. There's no doubt. You're getting benefits from PERS, or you're about to, or you've been contributing. You're concerned about the financial stability of the program because it's been discussed quite a bit, finally, in the last couple of years. This didn't just happen overnight. It's just finally starting to get some attention down there at the Capitol. And so they're concerned. Right now, the only action that's been taken by the legislature concerning the public employees' retirement system is the creation of a new tier known as Tier 5. That's because it follows the present, most recent created tier 4. And all a tier is, it's a period of time defined for each tier within which a person who is hired enrolls in the program in accordance with all the plan structure of that tier, both in terms of the key issues, key factors, your contribution rate, your employer's contribution rate, the number of years required to vest to earn benefits, the number of years used in calculating your average pay for the calculation of your benefit amount, the number of years upon which you can retire, either having vested or if you've got a certain number of years, you can retire at any age. Those are the key sorts of distinctions between the tiers. The cost of living adjustments, another key feature of a tier and how that's calculated. So the creation of this new Tier 5 is a significant departure from prior tiers in that it is not a pure defined benefit program like standard PERS is. It's a hybrid, what's called a hybrid. It's part defined benefit, part defined contribution. Again, quick primer, defined benefit simply means your benefits really aren't based on the amount of money you contribute into the system in a defined benefit program such as Social Security, such as PERS, and your benefits continue until you are no longer topside. Whereas in a defined contribution plan, you have an account assigned to you, you contribute to it, perhaps your employer does as well, standard 401k plan, that's what most people are familiar with, that would constitute a defined contribution plan. You pay in, maybe your employer pays in. You dictate how that money's invested. You get ready to retire. What the balance is in that account is all you got. Once you have withdrawn it, you're done. That's different than a defined benefit program. You withdraw until, again, you are no longer with us on the earth. So this is a combination of those two structures. That's what Tier 5 is. But here's the catch. So how does this help PERS? That's, I think, the typical question. How does this help stabilize the program, improve its financial condition? Here's how. The employee under Tier 5, by the way, this would be, I think, Rhino, for anyone hired July 1, right, 2025. Sometimes I confuse because there's another feature that changes the Supplemental Legislative Retirement Program, so-called SLRP, and that has a March 1st, 26 date. This is a 7/1/25 date, and here's how it works. New employees hired in the public sector by an employer who participates in PERS, they will pay 4% to the defined benefit plan, PERS, and they will pay 5% to their personal defined contribution plan. The contribution rate remains level at 9%, just like it is today. However, the employer, which presently is on track based on the increase in the rate passed a couple of years ago. We're headed to a 19.9% employer, that would be of wages, contribution rate. Well, all 19.9% goes to the PERS program, but the employee will only get half the benefits because they're only contributing roughly half of their total contribution to the PERS program. They're going to throw in 4%. Right now they contribute 9. The employer contributes 19.9. Under the new program, they're going to contribute 4. The employer, 19.9%. All of it goes to PERS, less coming out. Plus, no cost of living raise in this new tier. The legislature would have to authorize it for those who ultimately retire that participated in this new Tier 5. So that's how. Got more money going in. How many times have I said that on the program? I know people sometimes on social media, they kind of make fun of me on it. That's fine. I don't care. It's just trying to boil it down to what's just fact. Quit playing with all this complicated stuff. It ain't that complicated. More's got to come in or less got to go out or combination of the two. In this particular case, it's kind of a combination of the two. Employers, taxpayers, going to contribute the same amount. When the employee retires, less coming out. Simple as that. So the actuaries do all their complicated, fancy math and say, yeah, once that works out, looks like the program will be fully funded in 2064. Now, that helps. It stops the bleeding is what it does. Because the reality is, guys, every new employee hired today in the public sector puts more pressure on PERS. Every employee, because the contributions and the benefits don't match up. And it puts PERS in an even more negative position with the addition of each employee. So now all new employees go into Tier 5, and that actually helps PERS because more's coming in, less is going out. That was included in the tax bill. So the PERS people feel like that, hey, that really stops short of what's necessary to stabilize the program. And they're right. And I'll get to that in that respect. They're right. And I'll get to that on the other side of this break here in the Element Well studio. It's middays.
You're listening to Middays with Gerard Gibbert, here on Super Talk Mississippi.
Welcome back, everyone. It's midday. Thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate it. Yeah, so I tell you, just looking at some of the comments out on social media, Rhino, folks are upset, to say the least, about this tax legislation. It's hard to try to conclude anything from that, whether or not that's represents broad sentiment, universal sentiment. And I'm not looking at just my personal stuff. I'm looking at sites that have large number of followers, participants. And it's interesting. So one of the questions is, does the new tier increase retirement from 30 to 35 years? So it's age 62 with 30 years, 65 with 8 years, or 35 years with no limit. Currently, in the Tier 4, there are really only two features of retirement eligibility. 30 years of service, any age, 65 and 8. So it would go to 62 and 30, 65 and 8, same as 4, or 35 and no age. So you'd have to work another 5 years. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? Okay. So, yeah, so think about that. If you got to work another 5 years before you can retire at any age, well, that means you're going to pay in 5 years and you're going to receive benefits out for less than 5 years. It'd be no different than increasing the eligibility age in Social Security, something that's been talked about quite a bit. But once again, this stops short of completely resolving PERS's financial plight. But it does stop the bleeding. And that's important. And I know, Rhino, and you're with me on this, I believe. You look out on social media and the PERS people think, they don't care about us. They only care about themselves. They're not addressing this. They're not going to do anything. Folks, that's just not true. I talk to these people all the time. All the time. Privately. I'm at the Capitol a lot. Pushing them on this issue because I know it's important. Wrote the dang article about it a year and a half ago just to call attention to it. They know. I promise. And as we've said on the show many times, and we've asked many legislators that have come in the studio, are there any plans to reduce PERS benefits? Because wouldn't you agree, Rhino, that's the number one concern. You're going to do away with my cost of living adjustment, my 13th check. You're going to reduce benefits. Oh, wait, I'm within striking distance of retirement. It's not going to be there for me. Not a single one has ever said, yeah, I'm pushing legislation to change benefits. In fact, I've said numerous times, if they do, we'd end up in court and we'd lose. And the PERS members would own the state of Mississippi. A bit of an exaggeration, but not by much. So that's not the case. The challenge is, what do you do about it? Now, the good news is, it ain't like next year, everything falls apart. Same thing with Social Security. Although the situation, Social Security, Medicare, it's easy to say, much more urgent, because we're within 8 or 10 years of that being a huge problem. So I do think that there's going to have to be more action. And that primarily, I expect, is going to come in the form of increasing employer contributions, just like we just did. 5% over 5 years. Where are we now, Rhino? Year two of that, I think, seems like. It's 0.5% each year for five for a total of 2.5, taking us from 17.4 to 19.9. That's where we're headed. That's the employer contribution rate. In other words, for every $100 of wages paid to a PERS member, the employer pays $19.90 to their PERS fund. So 20% roughly of their wages is an expense to PERS for an employer, plus Social Security, plus Medicare, plus unemployment, plus workers' comp. Next thing you know, for every dollar you're paying someone who's in the PERS program, you're paying about 35 to 40 cents in this additional burden. That's where we're headed. They know. It's just what to do about it. So that's what I think is going to happen. We're going to end up increasing the employer contribution rate even further. Here's what's notable about that. I know everybody out there, including me, says, hey, we need to think about cutting spending. I'm with you at the state level. Unnecessary, frivolous, extraneous, wasteful, duplicative spending. Absolutely. Let's cut it. Let's get rid of it. But at the same time, you're increasing the employer contribution rate to take care of PERS, which is an increase in spending, significant increase in spending. That's why that's so dang hard to do. And we're seeing the same thing in the federal government. It's easy to say that. I mean, I see it every dead gum day. Somebody on the Republican side from Washington, we just got to cut the spending. And I'm thinking, dude, you're the one that signed off on the legislation. And by the way, you don't touch where the increases are occurring substantially. And that's Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, interest costs, veterans benefits, a myriad of other federal assistance programs, Obamacare subsidies, down the list. That's where all the dang spending increases are being incurred. You're only talking about the 15% that you actually appropriate. In other words, you're not serious. So same thing with respect to the state's budget and taxes. The big oversight, in my view, on this, Rhino, is that everybody's complaining about the gas tax, the increase in the gas tax, but nobody seems to acknowledge the decrease in the sales tax on groceries. It's like that didn't even happen. But how many times have you and I heard, man, they need to decrease the sales tax on groceries? Well, here you go. July 1, it goes from 7 to 5, and like that doesn't enter into their equation.
It's almost like the most vocal and ardent naysayers were going to be upset and have their panties in a twist no matter what happened.
And I'm just astonished by that. So,
are you?
I
won't say sizable, but there's a portion of the population that lives in the Magnolia State that seems to get up every morning with the sole purpose in their life being to get offended and outraged over something they have no control over and doesn't impact them in the slightest.
And here's where I'm going with that. Please sit down, folks, and think about, do a little analysis. How much do I spend on gas? And by that, you would need to know how many gallons you consume, because excise tax is applied per gallon. And then think about how much you spend on groceries. Now, I did that math in my household, by the way. It's not a huge amount of money, but it saved me about $140 a year. That's the way I did the math. When I consider in my household, it's just my wife and I have two adult children, live on their own. But I looked at my wife and I and essentially how much gas, how many gallons we both consume. And then I looked at our grocery bill on average. And I did the math on that. I took 2% off my grocery bill, and I added 9 cents per gallon of the gallons, and I did the simple math. But I've seen people like, this is going to cost me thousands. Like, you drive that much? I mean, I saw where one person said that they're that they knew of a person who's in the trucking business. Now, of course, they're going to drive a whole lot more than the average person, and naturally this is going to have a bigger impact on them. But the figure that they suggested it was going to cost them, I did the math on that. Like, wow, that's a lot of gallons. I mean, hundreds of thousands of gallons per year. Just sit down and do the simple math before you jump to conclusions. And this is not defending or advocating for one or the other. I'm just saying figure your situation out, because I know and I appreciate retired people in our state who have earned their benefits and worked their lives, and now they're comfortably retired and they're receiving income as a result. And that income, retirement income per se, is not subject to income tax. So they look at this and say, well, you're not helping me, but we are decreasing the grocery sales tax, though we're increasing the sales tax on, or the excise tax on fuel. Do the net of that. I bet you'll find most of you probably net benefit, unless you travel a lot. Now, everybody's situation's different, and certainly we appreciate that. And if it's not, it's probably pretty close to a wash, no change. And then, of course, the other complaint is, wow, I got to wait 14 years for the income tax to be eliminated. We'll talk about that a little more on the other side of the break. Stay with us.
Patriotism.
You're listening to Middays with Gerard here on Super Talk Mississippi.
Yeah.
Welcome back. It's Middays, Super Talk Mississippi. Why does PERS, this is Wiley Walker from Newton, why does PERS pay retiree benefits to incarcerated persons when Social Security does not pay these? Well, first I would say, how many dang PERS people do we have that are incarcerated? That's kind of disturbing. The second thing I would say is, yes, Social Security, it is true, their benefits are suspended with a criminal conviction. If they're incarcerated for more than 30 continuous days for a criminal. However, if benefits are going to the spouse or the children, they still flow. They still remain eligible for those. With respect to incarcerated persons, my guess is, Wiley, that when the laws that created the PERS program were enacted, they just didn't think about people being locked up. I could be wrong. I don't know. Maybe that was intentional. But how many people is that? Surely that can't amount to a whole lot. We got bigger problems, I would say, again, if that's the case. Oh, boy. Let's see. So, yep, somebody's not happy with what we're talking about here today. So, the president has said that he's up for a third term. And he says he thinks that he can skirt the Constitution or figure out a way to get around the Constitution to do so. He's talking about being elected as the vice president to a president, J.D. Vance, and then J.D. Vance resigning, and then he taking over as the president. That's what
he's
talking
about.
Yeah, I think so, too. But he says
he's... Also don't think that's... I think in order to run for vice president, you have to technically be able to be the president.
Yeah.
Which, if you've served two terms, you cannot technically be the president anymore.
Yep. That's exactly what it says. But he says that...
the only way you can get more than two terms as a president is if you take over a term, not take over a term before your term served or elected, not after.
Yeah. Agree.
But it's going to drive people crazy on the left, and they're going to lose their minds over it.
Yeah. Why, let's see, there was another question. Bubba says, I'm not upset about the increase in the gas tax, and thankfully for the 2% decrease in groceries, but what does upset a lot of people is that they're taking credit for doing away with state income taxes. Call it what it is. It was never about state income taxes. Well, it is going to be eliminated. It's just over a period of time. I mean, out there on social media, vote them out. Jackson needs a good cleaning. The bill law looks like proof that the citizens of Mississippi have absolutely no voice in Jackson. Hopefully these 4 years will go by fast or people will wise up, send them packing. I mean, it's just the whole tier five is going to be awful for all jobs that fall under PERS. Time for our state employees to start planning a visit to Jackson and let the masses be heard and encourage our leaders to take action towards ditching tier five and funding PERS. Nothing but a shell game and hurts all employees and departments, blah, blah, blah. So, unbelievable, the response. Bo in Indianola. Now, Bo, are you in the trucking business? He says he consumes about 400 to 500 gallons a week. So that works out to, what, 20-something thousand gallons a year, I guess. But aren't you in the trucking business, Bo? I mean, it's a little different. You're not the typical resident, the typical motorist.
Yeah, but even if you take, what, 500 gallons a week, 9% or 9 cent increase, you're looking at, what?
$5?
Less than 2,500 over the span of a year.
Right. And that's your business. Now, it's a question for Bo if you're in the trucking business. Most folks that I know that are in that business have, like, a fuel surcharge. It's part of their contracts that they can adjust the price up based on a fuel surcharge. It's like built in. It's not like a static fat fee. Yeah, he says he hauls cars and equipment. So this will put us, I think, second only to one of the neighboring states in terms of our excise tax per gallon. So let's see. Well, something else. I'm offended at them being offended. I thought 20 years retirement for state employees depends on the tier, Ricky. Depends on the tier. I just cited for you that the tier, the present tier, which is tier four, just cited that for you. And that is 30 years. There are prior tiers where you're right. It was fewer than that. Does the state not match the 4% contributed by employees to the private plan like in the private sector, or does the part of retirement the state pays essentially the match? Yes. So the state does not, under Tier 5, the employer will not match the 5% going to the defined contribution plan. It will contribute the full 19.9% as it presently does to the PERS fund. Employers have the option, if they would like, have the discretion to contribute to the employee's defined contribution plan. Coming right back after Fox News and Super Talk News with Representative Rob Roberson.
Your of Middays with Gerard Gibbert is brought to you by the Mississippi Business Journal. Visit msbusinessjournal.com. Scott Coopwood, publisher and president.
Get ready. Get ready to go beyond the headlines and join a meaningful conversation with people from around the state.
Hello.
You're listening to Middays with Gerard Gibbert here on Super Talk Mississippi.
Welcome back, everyone. It's Middays, hour two of the program. It's a short show Monday. Ricky Matthews, Super Talk Outdoors, comes your way at 12:05. But right now, it's Rob Roberson. He's a member of the Mississippi House of Representatives, represents District 43, which includes Oktibbeha and Winston County, serves as the chair of the House Education Committee. Representative Roberson, good to see you, sir.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. So, let's see, what time are you guys gaveling in today? 1 o'clock?
Or 1 o'clock.
1 o'clock, that's what I thought. Yeah. What do you expect? Of course, the House did not convene over the weekend. The Senate did. They I think, came in for a little while on Saturday. Of course, we're at the point of the session with sine die approaching this Sunday, April 5th, where you guys are trying to get the revenue and appropriations bills all squared away into the governor. Where does that stand right now, to your knowledge?
I think that we'll probably get it done this week. I think one of the things that the speaker really wanted to emphasize is we've been here for 3 months. I mean, I don't know that being here on a Saturday and a Sunday it was going to do any more than being here on, you know, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. So I feel like he's just trying to send a message that, you know, we should be able to get these things done during the time that we have. And I do believe that we will. I do believe that in the past we've always had a conference weekend, but I think sometimes we need to look at ourselves and say, you know, we should be able to get this done in a reasonable amount of time.
Yeah. You know, it's one of those things where I know you got to get legislation passed to understand the total spectrum of inputs to the budgeting process, but you kind of wonder if we ought to reverse the sequence and do the revenue and appropriations at the beginning of the session and spend a whole lot of time focused on that instead of this kind of rush that it always feels like, you know, towards the end.
It really does feel that way. I think that having all of this done on the front end probably would be a smart move. However, you know, a lot of times the projects aren't going to be finished up as far as getting the information in from our communities. So a lot of people would probably like to keep it the way it is. But I think, frankly, doing it in the beginning, kind of knowing what your numbers are from the get-go would really be a lot easier than what we end up doing here at the end.
Yeah, I agree. Give us an update from your perspective on education. You being the chair of the education committee, what were the accomplishments? Let's start with that.
Well, I will say this: I think we're living in some really exciting times. Between the fact that you have the feds that that obviously look like they're going to take a step back away from the states and let the states and the communities run their schools, or at least that's what it appears to be. I think some of the accomplishments that we were able to do this year, we got some good things in the making for trying to attract teachers that are in the works. Some of the things that I had pushed, or at least wanted to have conversations about, we didn't make the strides in those directions that I would have liked to have made. However, I do think that the Senate and the House are going to have some meetings this summer. We're going to talk about the Tim Tebow bill. We're going to hopefully talk about consolidation and some things that will help put our schools back in a place where they're financially able to make it in the future. I do think we'll have some conversations about what school choice looks like for Mississippi. School choice is going to look a little different for every state that goes down that avenue, and I think for us it needs to look a little different too. So finding some agreement between the House and the Senate on those things, I think, will be a wonderful achievement for the summer. I'm not as optimistic about what we have accomplished for the 2025 session. However, that's just part of it. You can't expect to hit a home run every time you go up to bat.
Yeah. What about our teacher pay, Representative Robertson? Are you concerned about that? I note that the neighboring states, of course, that we often compete with for teachers are busy increasing the pay for their teachers somewhat. Where do we stand relative to those adjacent states these days?
Oh, goodness. Trying to run down the southeastern average is really like trying to chase down a moving target. And anytime we move, they move, and which is not a bad thing
sure.
for teachers. I think that's a wonderful thing that we could do. I think over the course of the next couple of years, we will have to revisit these things and see where we are, see where we're going. I'll say that the changing our retirement system has probably not been the most beneficial thing for attracting teachers or frankly, police officers or anybody else to the public service. But I think, you know, to shore some of these things up, we had to do what we did this year. I do want to remind folks that we go back every year and we'll be able to look at these things and see how they're working and be able to maneuver with these things, whether that be an increase in pay for teachers or whether that be looking at our retirement system as to how that's working to attract people into the jobs and what that looks like long term. I can say that it's pretty obvious to me that the Tier 5 is a little less than what I would have liked to have been, but I think that everybody feels that way. And sometimes when you're trying to stay within a budget and you're trying to stay, keep a system afloat, you have to make some pretty hard decisions, and I do appreciate what the members of the board for our retirement system, what they ask us to do, and those were some hard decisions, and we were able to do those this year. But I do want to remind everyone, we will be coming back every year looking at these things, and hopefully, as things get better, we'll be able to make things better.
Yeah, the Tier 5 situation is something that I've seen sort of mixed reviews on. You know, some are welcoming it as a way to at least begin the process of stabilizing the PERS program, and others are saying that this could be a significant hindrance in hiring new staff.
It may be. There may very well be. I will say that the bulk of the officers that I've talked to or teachers that I've talked to, especially when they're young, the retirement system's not necessarily something that's first and foremost on their minds. They just want to be that profession in which they've chosen.
Yeah.
I would like to return to this as we are able to dig our way out of this proverbial hole that we're in and make certain that we're covering our retirees in the future. I do think that in the future we'll be able to do something better, but we're kind of in a short we're in the short run right now, and we've got to get some things fixed so that we can move forward.
Yeah, and of course, the Tier 5 creation with the governor's signature on HB1 last week, that is really the only action we've seen on the PERS program. Before you guys get out of there this year, do you expect perhaps another lump sum transfer to the fund?
I think there's a possibility of a drop in there if we need to. I think that the speaker and the lieutenant governor have got to kind of come to terms with what we're going to do. I'm still like you. I wish we would have had these conversations in January and February instead of waiting until, you know, the end of March and first of April to do this. But this is just a part of the process.
Yeah.
And I think we just we have to work with what we got sometimes.
Yeah, you're right. Let's talk about we're up against a break. Can you hang around with us for another segment? We got about a couple of minutes left. We keep talking on the other side. Are you good?
Yes, sir.
Okay. School choice, wanted to get back on that again. You have done an enormous amount of work in your chamber on this issue and been involved in authoring legislation, anything from just basic open enrollment, portability, public to public, all the way through universal school choice. But once again, we come away with drilling a dry hole here. What's the issue in the Senate, do you feel, that's precluding anything from happening there?
I think a portion of this is that you have such an array of opinions and no one can come to a full understanding of what they want to move forward with. I think that's part of it. I have a tremendous amount of respect in my Dennis DeBar, president on that side. He's I think a lot of times he and I agree on where we would like to go, and it's just hard to move a larger group of people in that direction, especially whenever you do have certain schools that are doing well and no one wants to harm those. And then on the flip side of it, you have a local control on schools that aren't doing so well, and they don't want to lose control of that either. So there's this pushback from local districts as we move forward. Now, the funny thing is, whenever you ask a parent, hey, you know, are you in favor of choosing the school in which your child goes to, the vast majority of them say yes, that they would, you know, they'd like to be able to do that.
Yeah.
But when, you know, the devil's in the details.
Hold your thought there, Rob. Hold your thought. We're taking a break. We'll come right back. Continue the discussion. Thanks.
You all.
Middays with Gerard Gibbert.
Let's do this.
On Super Talk Mississippi.
Let's go.
Back with you in the Element Well studio. We're visiting with Representative Rob Robertson. So let's continue that discussion, Rob. You were talking about your discussions with your counterpart, Senator Dennis DeBar, chairs the Senate Education Committee over on the Senate side. And while I don't expect you necessarily to comment, I mean, in my experience over the years, just advocating for various school choice measures, I don't think he's ever even brought one up in his committee. He generally just dispenses with them before they even get any discussion. It just doesn't feel like there's any interest over on the Senate side to really passing any form of school choice measures.
I think on the outside looking in, it could look that way. I think that sometimes it comes down to whether or not the chairman thinks he can make any hay on the floor whenever he gets out there.
Yeah.
I do think that if we could have some meetings this summer and let us all sit down and look at what we think the numbers will be, where this will go, I think that would be easier for him to get his people online with what they want. I really do. I don't want to ever suggest that they're not looking at these things, because I do think that they're wanting to make everything better and move forward with a more of a progressive idea of what this will look like for the state. But on the same token, I mean, we are dealing with two different chambers, and my people are way more interested in flushing these types of things out than I think necessarily maybe the Senate may be. But that's sometimes they're ahead of something that we're not. So I don't want to put too much dispersion on that.
Yeah, okay. All right, appreciate that. Fair enough. So let's talk about something you and I have discussed a couple of times down at the Capitol, and that's the notion of consolidation of school districts. You had a measure that I think would require that, and then that got somewhat amended to essentially just establish a task force to really dig into this situation. What are your thoughts on that? Where do we stand?
I think that the task force itself is dead just because of the bills that died.
Yeah.
However, we don't have to have a task force to go look at this stuff. I've actually got MDE to start pulling some information for us to see what this looks like across the state. I do think we need the numbers. We need to know how many of these schools are doing well, how many of these schools are not doing well, what is the population. You cannot run a school district on 500 to 1,000 kids. You just can't. And for whatever reason, we have a lot of your superintendents out there have the impression that, you know, we would rather, you know, just put more money into it than not. Now, I have heard the argument, oh, well, you know, we don't seem to have a problem with it when it comes to the schools that we created outside of the regular public school system. However, I think everything is on the line. When you're looking at school districts and whether they are supporting the kids, and which is what they should be doing, then it really doesn't matter what direction it goes in. We just need to make certain that the money that we are providing for them is being used exclusively for educating these kids and not just pumping administrative costs up and moving forward in that direction. We've got school districts with superintendents, several assistant superintendents. Then we have principals and assistant principals. And by the time you've spent all this money in a school district, especially if it's a really small school district, you haven't done anything that's going to create anything but jobs for the adults, but we're not educating these kids the way we should. So I think getting these numbers from MDE, getting some help learning what this looks like, and I would love to see us go to 82 districts, but if we only get to 100 districts, I'm going to say that's a success. We just got to keep whittling these things down until we have something that works for the state. Whenever you look at other states, and the superintendents they have, they can cover 10,000 kids in one district. We seem to have a hard time if it gets over 3,000 or 4,000 kids. We seem to need more and more administrative costs, and I think that's something we should be pushing back on a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I know the speaker seemed to be pretty excited about such a project, but it just kind of fizzled out. Nothing happened, and I think I can honestly speak for a large number of Mississippians who believe that we have excess costs associated with administration of education in the state and an outsized amount of dollars flow into administration and not going directly into the classroom.
I think that's a fair assessment, and I think the good superintendents out there would agree with that. I spoke with a group of superintendents last week, and these are some of the best for the state. And they didn't disagree that some of this didn't need to be looked at. They're a little nervous when we talk about consolidation or when you talk about school choice. However, they're thoughtful people, too. And I think when it's all said and done, a lot of your professionals in that world, especially the really good ones, I think they're excited about moving forward in the challenges that are to come. They didn't become superintendents because they were – I really do believe the good ones are looking for a challenge, and these are challenging times if you're in that world, and it's an opportunity for these people to leave their mark. So I want to encourage the good ones out there, the good superintendents, get involved, stay involved, and keep in touch with me and Dennis both whenever it comes to these things.
Yeah. The lieutenant governor is also a person, of course, who has very – strong control over the Senate, which is the way our system works. I'm not saying that he's unique in that respect. You've been around the building long enough to know that. That's how it works.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, plus he's elected, so he's not subject to being elected by his membership there in the Senate. He's elected by the people at large. He's not a big fan, of any kind of education freedom. And in particular, he's made it very clear. He opposes the allocation of any public money to private schools. He has concerns about that. Do you think there's any chance for the duration of his tenure that we might even get to that level?
I think there's always the possibility of getting there, but it's there's so many different routes to this, and one of these routes, and this is one of the things that some of the superintendents I talked about, if we put a situation out there with school choice, and if we came to the middle where the public schools had less regulations on them and the private schools had a little more regulations on them that would meet them in the middle, is there a possibility that we could get a deal on something like that? Now, one of the reasons your private schools don't want to take this money is they don't want to be allocated with the same things that the public schools have to do. And my mama used to tell me that what was good for the goose is good for the gander. And I would like to see us come to the middle and reduce some of the requirements that our public schools are having to do. And that's really special in the fact that we're looking at what the feds have done, sending this back to us. If testing is a problem that we have, that we're over testing, let's sit down and have a conversation about that. If making certain that money is being spent, public money is being spent on our teachers and on our students the way it should be, let's make certain that is done in our private schools if they accept this money. Because that's been one of the concerns that I've heard the lieutenant governor mention would be, you know, that we're just handing over money without any process to make certain it's not being used unethically. And so I do believe there's ways that we can get there. It just is a matter of how do we approach this and what conversations do we have to make this happen.
Yeah. You know, and I guess I would just respond with that thought that, hey, look, the market will sort that out. If folks are looking to use their state allocated per student funding to help with a private school education, and that doesn't improve the educational outcome of their student, well, then they'll go back to the public school. I mean, the market
right.
is going to figure that out. We don't need government to come in and regulate that, in my view. But
I
get that that's a concern, you know, and I think what gets lost there is that we're not talking about just this big pool of public money. We're talking about the amount that's allocated for that student and just giving the parent some latitude and control over how that gets applied to the proper setting.
If I were a superintendent and principal of a good school, I would welcome the challenge
yes.
for any school for that. So I agree with that analogy. I think the good schools out there are going to flourish. Someone asked me, what's going to happen to the bad schools? Well, the bad schools are not going to survive. And that's just a reality.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's amazing what a little competition and a little choice would do to motivate and inspire and, I think, produce much better educational outcomes, even in the public schools. That's the piece of this that often gets overlooked. We got to go. We certainly appreciate you joining us today. Representative Rob Robertson represents District 43. And I know you guys got about an hour and a half. You'll be down at the Capitol. Appreciate it, Rob. Thanks, man.
Yes. Yes, sir. Thank you. Y'all have a good one.
You too. Coming right back in the Element Well studio.
Bring it on.
Middays with Gerard Gibbert.
It is on.
On Super Talk Mississippi.
Welcome back to the Element Well studio. It's middays. Mo says a couple of things. Let me go back here. He said something about doing the math. I thought he did. Maybe I missed it. Yeah, he says we go through a tank of gas about 18 gallons a week. We spend on average $200 a week in groceries. Definitely works out for us. So he did the math there that we were talking about earlier. Also sent us something about, who's this, Flat Rock School District? That's in Alabama. 64 students. Yeah. And someone sent us something down here about, Jim from Ripley, Tippah County, his two districts might have 500 students between the two. I think it's just under 500 in each, Jim, but you're right. And I can tell you, I've actually had a discussion with Representative Rob Robertson about the prospect of combining those two districts just because they're so small and losing population, by the way, which is a huge problem in the state of Mississippi. In some areas. Some areas are growing, some areas are dropping population, experiencing a decline, but you still got the same overhead and apparatus associated with school district. And we've talked about that. And, of course, that's met with strong objection, as you can imagine. And that's what's hard here. And it's, I can tell you, it's not universally supported. It just depends. Almost nobody wants to lose their district. I mean, I think that's pretty safe to say, we'd like to go combine with another one. Because when you do that, of course, you no longer have two different school boards that are elected by two different sets of people that are likely implementing, perhaps, two different approaches in governing and orchestrating, or administering, I should say, the schools in that district and the education. So, I'm for it. I think there's lots of opportunities to consolidate in the state. I think it needs to be done methodically and somewhat surgically. I'm not so sure that just a declaration that, hey, look, we're going to have one district per county. I don't think that would be publicly popular. I would encourage you, wherever you live, to think about what that would look like in your specific counties. Now, if you don't have children, you probably don't care. Maybe you don't. Maybe you do. But I think a lot of people, parents with children, would object. I know in my home county, they certainly do. They object to the prospect of Madison County school districts combining with Canton in Hinds County, the biggest in the state, Jackson Public Schools. You talk about combining Jackson with Clinton, for example. Nearby Rankin County, you would have Rankin County forging together with the Pearl separate school district. So, of course, you wouldn't have but one back office apparatus, not two. I'd caution against assuming you could just eliminate totally one and transfer all that workload to the one that remains. It's going to land somewhere in the middle. Still represents a net savings, no doubt about that. And then you'd have a much more diverse school board representation as well. And that may or may not be acceptable to a lot of people. Adam and Baldwin says, I'm all for some consolidation, but like Baldwin has its own school district, the town Prentice in Lee counties. Not following that. Elementary school is in Lee and middle and high school are in Prentice. Huh. I don't... Lee County, though, that's Tupelo. So, not sure what they're talking about there. But that, no doubt that you get into these sticky, thorny situations when you talk about consolidating school districts, for sure. Joe in Quitman says that Mr. Robertson was on Richard Cross. He said travel could be part of combining schools, not just a district administration. He's absolutely right. That's an issue when you think about a county having one district and one set of schools. I mean, but that doesn't mean that necessarily that you limit the number of schools. It just means you limit the back office. But that has been expressed as a concern when you start talking about travel. No doubt about that. Had to pick a spot in the middle of the three counties, so now new schools have to be built and paid for by county taxpayers and students based on extra hour or more. It's just really hard when you've got a sparsely populated area that you're trying to serve. There's no doubt that dramatically exacerbates this issue. When you've got densely populated areas, it's much easier to achieve. Thomas and Greenwood has sent an absolute book today. He wants you to know, for the most part, Rhino, that he can beat the markets, by the way. And he, if he had control over his own money, if he were, for example, a public sector employee in a defined contribution plan, he could ensure that his benefits would be substantially greater than anything that the PERS program would provide, which, of course, are benefits for life. He wants you to know that. He's absolutely cracked the code on the markets. He says public employees sacrifice so much. He's being facetious here. They gave up making $1 million a year to serve the public and make low pay. At least that's what they say on Friends of PERS. He's talking about the Facebook site. Soften the blow on Tier 5 by showing what people can make, a 401k versus the peanuts you get from defined benefit. So, Thomas, I know, man, you've cracked the code. You've figured it out. You can absolutely ensure that all these people who are going to contribute 5% of their income, let's just say a $50,000 a year teacher contributes $2,500 a year to their defined contribution plan, and let's say they work 30 years. What's that, Rhino? About $75,000? That they're, from that, going to be able to invest over that 30 years, $75,000 to generate enough money to live for another 30. Show me your pro forma on that, Thomas. Now, one of the things we should be concerned about as well is just the markets and how they are not too happy with the present economic conditions, and that is causing problems. Let's see here. What else we got? Yeah, Andy, who I know is passionate about school choice. Rhino, you know that. We've seen many of his texts and read them. And he's talking about the government getting involved. This is an objection, Andy. You know that, and I disagree with it, that hey, if we're going to let public money fund and be used as vouchers to defray some of the cost of private school tuition, it depends on the private school. So the amount you get is the amount you get. If you choose a private school that's more expensive than that, you are responsible for the excess. It could be a situation where the private school tuition is less than the amount that's allocated per student for a public school education. And I agree with you, Andy. I disagree with the notion that we've got to have more government oversight and regulation over the private school to essentially support the idea of public-to-private transfer. I completely agree with you on that. As I said with Representative Robertson, the market will figure that out. If you're using your money that you're getting for your child at a public school, take it with you and transfer it to be used for private school education, and that private school education isn't improving your child's education, well, then you're going to back out of school. I mean, the market will sort that out. And by the way, the word's going to get around, hey, don't think about doing that because that private school doesn't perform very well. That's what I think ought to happen. Mosa said something earlier about President Trump successful in deleting the Department of Education. Can our state DOE eliminate all the required testing and reporting? You know, those are guidelines more than they are requirements, Mose. It's still administered at state level. We can do away with a lot of that right now. They just choose not to. And I can't really explain why. And it's hard to tell in any discussion coming out of Washington how that would affect funding for public school education here in the state of Mississippi, or all the states for that matter. Darren and Jackson says they're superintendents because it's lucrative. I say let the market sort that out. And these are school boards that are hiring the superintendents and that are determining the compensation for said superintendents. The market should sort that out. If you know, we're not happy about that, our remedy is to elect school board members who won't approve of those pay packages. You have an opportunity to do that. Let's see what else. Why can't you just do what the people want, says Paul and Hernando. And, you know, the real answer to that, Paul, is that it's controversial as to what the people want. I mean, there have been different organizations who have done polls. It just depends. It really does. I've seen a lot of people very vocally opposed to any form of school choice. And, in fact, I can name a few races in the House in particular where the advocate for school choice was soundly defeated because of their advocacy. So it really just varies from area to area around the state. Final segment next.
If you're...
Are we going to do this?
Middays with Gerard Gibbert.
Keep rolling. 3, 2, 1.
On Super Talk Mississippi.
We are back in the Element Well studio. I don't care if they hire or fire people in the Mississippi educational system as long as the kids benefit from any actions done. That's Kevin for Brandon. Yeah, I think most people would agree to that. As far as urban school districts, to me, it seems the failing districts, this is on the ceasefire text line, are trying to merge with the passing ones for whatever reason, maybe to try to provide gain in the failing district. Canton had the opportunity to join Madison County years ago and decided not to. Now that it is a failing district, they want to join Madison County. I don't remember that. I don't think that's the case, but you may correct me if I'm wrong on that. Baldwin City Limits is in Prentice and Lee counties. Okay, I got you. Spans the counties. I see what you're saying now. So, yeah, but you still could accomplish school district consolidation, even if it's across the counties. I get the nuance there based on the one per county, but you could take the Baldwin City School District, split it up. If we were to reduce down to one district per county, wouldn't be a problem. What else we got here? Somebody said something about, I'm looking for it. I apologize for that. I'm looking for it. And that has to do with transportation. So their assertion was, well, they want more money in the form of fuel taxes to hire more people. That's actually never been the rationale for increasing the excise tax that I've heard from the executive director, Brad White, or the transportation commissioners. Their contention has always been, and help me, Rhino, if I misstate this, contention's always been that a recurring, reliable stream of additional revenue is needed to access additional federal funds for the purpose of new road construction and maintenance on existing roads. And the reason is because the federal government says, okay, if you want these grants, which, by the way, it already funds, 60% we get of our Department of Transportation budget comes from the federal government, not the state government. But what they've always said is, if you want to apply for grants, you have to show as part of that application process, you state have a steady stream of revenue to maintain these new projects, right? That's what we've heard.
Yeah, the way I've heard it analogized.
Yep.
Is if you're going to the bank to ask for a loan, what's your better angle? Walking in with a one-time payment you just got from your last job, or walking in with a pay stub saying you have gainful employment to get a loan from the bank? They want to know that you're going to continue with this, that you're serious about it, that you didn't just move stuff around. I quit my job. I got this. Give me some money. Same thing with the federal government. They don't want a one-time appropriation to then send money down. They want it to be, all right, this is y'all's plan going forward. This is the money you've set aside for it. We're going to help.
And the point there, that's how we have filled the financial gaps over the last few years, is just by cutting a check from other funds. You guys likely don't see that because it's not really part of the budget, if you will, because it's what's called a balance sheet transaction, just a transfer of cash from one fund over to another fund. So it's not an expense. in the way you would think about it as far as general fund spending is concerned. Yeah, it was Greg from Newton. And that's just not true, Greg. And don't want to be argumentative with you here, or confrontational. But and it's not true as far as what the transportation commissioners and the executive director have said. They've never said, certainly in our discussions with them, that they want to go hire more people. And you're absolutely right in that the vast majority of the construction and maintenance in the state is outsourced, is contracted, and those costs have gone up sharply. And one of the issues is, I'm told there are only like four that routinely submit bids as requested by the Department of Transportation to do the work. And because there are only four, they're able to charge higher prices. I mean, their margins are up because the competitive landscape is not as significant. So that's one of the issues that's plaguing us. We currently have the 49th lowest fuel tax in the country. This would put us in the top 25. This would kind of leapfrog us, the 9 cents that we're talking about here. And, of course, the excise tax that's presently in place has been there since 1987. So I'm just passing on. That's not an advertisement in favor of raising the gas tax. It's just sharing the facts around that issue. Yeah, on the C Spire text line, talking about school choice, this money doesn't belong to the government. Yeah, I agree. I think giving parents latitude over how the funds dedicated, allocated to their child or invested in the proper school choice setting makes total and complete sense. Why don't the conservatives in our legislature act like conservatives? We could accomplish so much if not for the lieutenant governor. That's Darren in Jackson. He would call himself very conservative, Darren. In fact, he's going to be on the program, I believe, tomorrow. You'll want to tune in for that. We're out of here today. Back with you again tomorrow. Until then, stay safe and God bless.
A Super Talk Mississippi Media Production.